Pureza, London.
Russia, Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Industrial production in the EU's top economy, Germany, has suffered an unexpected decline. It's bad news for the entire bloc. However, a forecast published on Monday suggests the EU's economy is set to grow modestly. But downside risks are also growing.
Russia's war of aggressions against Ukraine continues to cast a long shadow of uncertainty over the economy.
Grants to help struggling EU firms will soon be withdrawn, Eurozone finance ministers announced on Monday.
Companies that are receiving support will have to look at how they can support their own long-term viability.
A growing number of people are reaching the conclusion that the West could have prevented the war in Ukraine through constructive dialogue with Russia. The cost of living crisis resulting from the conflict is taking its toll.
It's time to be talking about peace, not about weapons or providing more financial aid to the war.
If the parties could come together and agree a peace, that would be wonderful, but you know, I'm not sure that's happening, right?
Apparently, financial markets are looking on nervously because so many things have been impacted by the war.
Due to the fact also of the uncertainties in China and lower exports and imports from China, and also due to the expectations of the economy in the United States.
A conference in Brussels on Monday heard that cracks are showing in the EU with respect to the war in Ukraine.
The Europeans have been united, but they need to be much more united.
Trade union members across the EU point out that wages are not keeping up with inflation as the bloc continues to spend billions of euro on arming Ukraine. Therefore, they suggest the onus is now on Western leaders to bring about de-escalation as a matter of urgency. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
A great open-hearted and free-thinking Iranian poet, as described by Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi in a message read to the audience by the Minister of Culture on the occasion of Persian Language Day. Credited for reviving the Persian language through his literary masterpiece Shahnameh or the Book of Kings, Hakim Abulqasim Ferdowsi is honored every year on the occasion. Persian or Farsi, as referred to by native speakers, is a branch of Indo-European languages. It is primarily spoken in Iran, Afghanistan, Uzbekistan, and Tajikistan, but widely understood in Central Asia. It is considered a relatively simple language to learn grammatically. It is written from right to left using a modified version of the Arabic alphabet. The Saadi Foundation in Tehran has made it its mission to promote the Persian language, Farsi. And Persian Language Day is the best opportunity for that.
Farsi is the key to a treasure chest full of gold coins. Our literature and Persian poems are the treasure inside that chest. I recommend everyone to learn Farsi.
I fell in love with classic Persian literature through the Ferdowsi's Shahnameh. It took him over 3 decades to write the book at a time when Arabic was the main scientific and literary language of Iran.
Shahnameh, or the Book of Kings, recounts Iran's mythical and historical past. The book is considered valuable cultural heritage for Iranians, while it serves as a great inspiration to learn Farsi for foreigners.
Foreigners say Persian is one of the most beautiful languages in the world. Persian Language Day is celebrated on May 15th to honor the world-renowned Persian poet Ferdowsi and his masterpiece Shahnameh, or the Book of Kings. Gisum Shahmadi, Tehran.
Palestinians in the besieged Gaza Strip marked the 75th anniversary of the Nakba Day, also known as the Day of Catastrophe, in front of the United Nations office. Nakba Day marks the displacement of Palestinians upon the establishment of the Israeli regime in 1948, when Zionists drove out hundreds of thousands of Palestinians from the historic land of Palestine. According to UN figures, there are currently around 5 million registered Palestinian refugees. Around 1.3 million refugees live in the Gaza Strip and reside in 8 refugee camps under miserable living conditions. The Palestinian Legislative Council in Gaza also held a special session commemorating 75 years of Nakba and called on the international community to stop turning a blind eye to the plight of Palestinians.
Palestinians expressing their disappointment of the UN representing the international community who had created the Zionist entity in 1948. And until now, after 75 years, they are failing to respond to the Palestinian ambitions and dreams of an independent, sovereign state.
Palestinian refugees, their children and their grandchildren hold sacred the right to return to the land of their ancestors. 75 years on, Palestinian refugees say they have not lost hope of taking back what is rightfully theirs.
In this 75th anniversary of Nakba, we said our right won't fall down. We as refugees here in Gaza, we said to the Israeli occupation, we will give back to our land. If it's not today, tomorrow, if it's not us, our children. So this right won't fall down.
Every year, as Palestinians mark the Nakba, they are not only commemorating the horrors that took place 75 years ago and the demolition of some 500 villages and towns, they are also marking the Nakba, or catastrophe, that continues in different forms to this day. Last Tuesday, the Israeli regime launched a 5-day onslaught on the Gaza Strip, killing and maiming scores of Palestinians, including innocent women and children.
The Palestinian Nakba of 1948 is still continue. We can see this every day here in Gaza. The last few days, the Israelis have attacked the 2.3 million innocent Palestinians, killed 33 Palestinians, wounded dozens, destroyed dozens of houses.
Nakba Day is commemorated annually by Palestinians and by millions of those who support them and their cause around the world.
Nakba Day is special for the people of Gaza, where most of the inhabitants are refugees and children of refugees. Despite decades of displacement, they refuse to give up the right of return to their hometowns and villages. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
In Canada's largest city, young Palestinians have taken the lead in remembering 75 years of resistance and the ongoing displacement and dispossession faced by Palestinians with the commemoration of Nakba Day in the streets of downtown Toronto.
The Zionists once upon a time said that the older generation will die and that the youth will forget. And we are here today proving not only that the youth will not forget, but that the youth will take up an active role in our people's struggle for national liberation. We believe that we have a responsibility to confront Zionism in our locales, wherever Zionism is.
Well, 75 years of occupation, 75 years of crimes against humanity. We're here to stand in solidarity with the Palestinian people. And we want liberation. We believe that we are the generation of liberation.
Journalist Shireen Abu Akle, murdered by Israeli troops 1 year ago, and political prisoner Kader Adnan were remembered among the numerous martyred and hundreds injured since the start of the year in historic Palestine amid an increase of violence by the Zionist occupation forces.
In the West Bank, we have seen continuous raids on cities like Jenin and Nablus, and these attempts have been to quell the youth that is rising up, resisting the settler colonial state that is taking away their rights and their right to live in dignity. We have seen home demolitions across historic Palestine in 48, in Al-Naqab, in Sheikh Jarrah. We have seen Palestinians being displaced. We have seen political prisoners succumb to their to medical negligence, a policy implemented by the Zionist entity intended to make sure that our political prisoners are effectively being slowly assassinated.
And so we are here saying that our prisoners carry the struggle forward and are our compass, that we will honor our martyrs and uphold their legacy, and we call on Palestinian youth and Arabs all across the world to play an active role in our struggle for national liberation.
Activists from a wide range of organizations are calling on Canadians to support Palestinian resistance by opposing Canada's contribution to Palestinian dispossession
and joining the demand to end the illegal occupation. Camila Escalante, Toronto.
Amid contradictory reports on the contents of the Egyptian-mediated ceasefire between Palestinian resistance group Islamic Jihad in the besieged Gaza Strip and Israel, Palestinian experts say that the Israeli regime is to abide by the agreement, at least for the time being, but they add that it's unclear how long the latest ceasefire will hold before the regime breaches it. Israel's seriousness will be determined to some extent by the length of the period of calm, they say.
Whether the Israelis are going to commit to this ceasefire, as we know that this is not the first time we have truce or ceasefire. It happened hundreds of times before, and all the time it was Israel who broke this kind of agreement, not just because the Palestinians do anything, but because the Israeli themselves and this kind of regime, the colonial racist regime, it's used to that.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, during a cabinet meeting on Sunday, told his ministers that the Israeli military took out the entire leadership of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad and by doing so fulfilled the goals of the so-called Shield and Arrow operation in perfect form. He also claimed that Tel Aviv had changed the equation and thwarted the entire top of the Jihad movement. Meanwhile, Israel's far-right minister Itamar Ben-Gvir has demanded that targeted killing be carried out against Palestinian resistance leaders in the West Bank as well. He added that the last operation was good and important, but it must be continued.
The most important thing is that the Israeli regime failed to achieve any political goal, failed in restoring deterrence, failed in oppressing the resistance or creating a fraction between the Palestinians themselves or between different factions. Netanyahu has maybe temporarily succeeded in regaining his popularity. However, he will face his problems within days. This round is failure to Israel.
Analysts, meanwhile, say one of the reasons Netanyahu agreed to the ceasefire is Thursday's controversial flag march that is held every year by the Israelis to mark the occupation of East Al-Quds in 1967 Six-Day War. This annual event has prompted fightings in past years as the Israeli regime insisted not to reroute the flag march away from the Muslim quarter of Al-Quds. Palestinians wonder whether the Israeli policies and killings in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds would affect in a way or another the inevitability of the ceasefire, mainly after Ben-Gvir's call to assassinate resistance leaders in the West Bank. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
From the disgrace of the Nakba to today's resistance. The 75th anniversary of the occupation of Palestine is a time to reflect on the long way the oppressed nation of Palestine has come in its struggle for freedom, while shedding light on the numerous instances of human rights violations committed by Israel in the Palestinian territories.
There are over 1,000 Palestinians currently jailed in administrative detention with no charge or no trial under a Zionist regime that can indefinitely extend their detention, leaving them jailed with no charge or no trial for years on end.
The issue of Palestine is the most important issue in the Muslim world, and Nakba is an occasion for all of us to condemn the atrocities against Palestinians. Resistance is the only way to liberate Palestine.
The Nakba has greatly influenced Palestinian culture, and now a new generation of Palestinians is ready to make the ultimate sacrifice in the fight for freedom.
Resistance has paid off. After years of resistance, now we have reached a point where there is no talk about the Greater Israel Project. That image of an invincible army has been shattered.
It's true that the Israeli regime has tried to create the impression that it's strong. We all know that they have the support of world powers. But today, the regime is facing lots of domestic problems. That's mainly the reason for the escalation of raids and attacks in the occupied territories and the Gaza Strip. It's a way to deviate attention from its internal issues. But the international community is now more aware than before.
Today, the word Nakba and what it stands for is known to all who are preoccupied by the Palestinian cause.
This year on May 15th, the United Nations will be holding a high-level special meeting to mark the 75th anniversary of the Nakba. This is the first time that the international body is marking the date, recognizing the historic injustice suffered by the Palestinian people. Gisumi Shahmadi, Tehran.
It was a gathering of defiance and hope, a chance for pro-Palestinian organizations and supporters to remind the international community they have not forgotten about justice for Palestine. 75 years on from the catastrophe, there was an urgent message for the world.
Today, and our first message is one of solidarity to the Palestinian people, those across historic Palestine from the river to the sea, those in the diaspora, the Palestinians expelled in 1948 and their descendants, who today are marking what happened in 1948, the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians, the destruction of more than 500 Palestinian villages, but are also marking the Nakba not as a moment rooted in the past, but an ongoing process of colonization, a dispossession and oppression.
Ongoing Israeli aggression and injustices mean the Nakba is not simply a historic moment, but one that demands an immediate response to the current situation.
The Nakba is ongoing, and we have seen the latest threads in that tapestry of the Nakba woven in Gaza, once again suffering the raining of Israeli bombs.
The international community continues to fail the Palestinians, not just for their role in the facilitation of the ethnic cleansing and displacement of the people, but for their continued political blind eye, a blind eye that allows Israel to act with impunity in its subjugation and oppression of Palestinians day in, day out. Britain's role in not just pushing through the Balfour Agreement, but London's current position as a staunch ally of Tel Aviv makes the demands of the marchers all the more pressing.
What we're asking for as a British public is sanction Israel. We're asking for international law to be upheld. If any other country was breaking this many laws this frequently on an international level, sanctions would be placed upon them without doubt. So we're asking for level playing field here, international law to be applied to Israel, sanction Israel now. The Nakba isn't a historical fact. It's a fact that's going on right now.
We want to see an end to UK-Israeli weapons trade going both directions, actually. It's not just a one-way street. We want to see an end to that. And we want to really call our government to account for its complicity, not only in the arms trade and so on, but the continuing repression within Gaza and within the occupied territories. Really, 75 years is way too long. It's 75 years too long, and we want to see the restoration of freedom and liberty to the Palestinian peoples, to their lands and to their state.
As Palestinians continue to resist the occupation with every resource available to them, those demonstrating are keen to show the spirit of solidarity across the globe remains steadfast. Amina Taylor, London.
In the limelight.
The British government has put strict policies on the agenda in order to prevent immigrants from entering the country. But many critics are extremely angry with this approach and consider it a violation of international laws. The Illegal Immigration Bill is the name of a project that the British government wants to use to prevent the illegal entry of refugees into the country. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Daily Mail has covered this story and tells us more. The head of the Church of England has condemned the UK government's illegal immigration bill that would dramatically limit the ability of asylum seekers to enter Britain, calling the policy isolationist, morally unacceptable, and politically impractical. The Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, made a rare appearance in Parliament in opposition to the bill. He told the House of Lords, the unelected upper house of Parliament, that the government's proposal was a short-term solution that could do a lot of damage to Britain's reputation. The bill prohibits asylum claims from anyone arriving in the United Kingdom illegally and forces authorities to detain and then deport refugees and migrants to their home country or a so-called safe third country, such as Rwanda. Once deported, they cannot re-enter the United Kingdom. Britain's Conservative government says the measure will annually prevent tens of thousands of people from trying to cross the English Channel in small boats in the hope of reaching Britain. Critics, however, including the United Nations Refugee Agency, have described the law as unethical and unenforceable, and some claim it violates international laws. The bill was approved in the House of Commons recently. It was on its second reading in the House of Lords on Wednesday, 10th of May. The House of Lords can amend the law, but not block it. The Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, who is also the spiritual head of the Anglican churches around the world and presided over the coronation of King Charles III, said international protections for refugees were not inconvenient obstacles to by any legal means necessary. He said it would be wrong for Britain to hand over the responsibility of resettling refugees to other, often much poorer countries. Justin Welby said, "Of course we cannot take everyone and nor should we, but this bill has no sense at all of the long term and the global nature of the challenge that the world faces. This nation should lead internationally, not stand apart." The British government has asked the House of Lords to back the bill, which it claims is designed to meet the will of the British people. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has pledged to stop the boats transporting refugees through the English Channel. More than 45,000 such migrants landed on England's southern coastline last year, up 500% in the past 2 years, and the government forecasts that the number would rise to 56,000 this year. British newspaper The Guardian has also covered this story and tells us more. Senior British judges have been urged to block UK government plans to send asylum seekers to Rwanda. In a 4-day hearing at the Court of Appeal, which concluded recently, the Lord Chief Justice, Lord Burnett, Master of the Rolls, Sir Geoffrey Voss, and Lord Justice Underhill, Deputy President of the Civil Division of the Appeal Court, heard an appeal against the High Court ruling last December that it was lawful to send some asylum seekers, including small boat arrivals, to Rwanda to have their claims processed rather than dealing with their applications for sanctuary in the United Kingdom. The new illegal migration bill, now passing through Parliament, states that all asylum seekers arriving via irregular means could face being forcibly removed to Rwanda. Those supporting the appeal against the ruling include the United Nations Refugee Agency, lawyers, charities, and a group of asylum seekers. The court heard from the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, UNHCR, that Rwanda has a record of human rights abuses towards refugees within its borders, including refoulement or forced removal to countries where they are at risk, expulsions and arbitrary detention. The refugee agency warned that the Britain's Home Office will not be able to guarantee the safety of asylum seekers who are deported to Rwanda. However, Sir James Eady, counsel for Suella Braverman, claimed the Home Secretary was confident that the government of Rwanda would abide by undertakings given in a memorandum of understanding signed by the two countries. Raza Hussein KC, representing six individual asylum seekers, told the court there were serious evidential gaps and deficiencies that the judges at the High Court had not properly examined. The United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, UNHCR, said the Rwanda plan will expose refugees to serious harm and the policy is incompatible with Britain's international obligations. Angus McCulloch, a lawyer for the Office of the High Commissioner for Refugees, said in a written argument submitted to the court, removal to Rwanda pursuant to the UK-Rwanda arrangement will expose asylum seekers to a real risk of breaches of the Refugee Convention. The charity Asylum Aid, which appealed against the High Court ruling alongside the group of asylum seekers, argued that those threatened with being sent to Rwanda have a right to a fair and reasonable decision-making process, and that this will not be possible when the 7 days allocated under the proposed system to make representations. The charity Freedom from Torture was given permission to intervene in the case. Turkey's Anadolu news agency has also covered this story. More than 830 UK health professionals and representatives from leading medical bodies have signed a letter to the Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, expressing grave concerns that the government's plan to send asylum seekers to Rwanda will cause catastrophic mental and physical harm to people seeking safety in advance of a recent Court of Appeal hearing on the policy. Signatories to the letter include the British Medical Association and the Royal College of Obstetrics and Gynaecologists. The letter says, subjecting people seeking sanctuary in the United Kingdom, many of whom have mental health conditions and have histories of torture, trafficking and trauma, to such an inhumane process is a matter of significant concern for the medical community. In the High Court last December, two senior judges found that the British government's plans were lawful, but quashed the cases of eight individual asylum seekers threatened with removal to Rwanda. While the ruling was welcomed by the government and the former Home Secretary Priti Patel, who announced the Rwanda deal on 14th of April 2022, permission to appeal was granted on some grounds. Recently, further permission to appeal was granted to consider whether the High Court judges had properly examined if Rwanda is a safe place to send asylum seekers. Grave warnings were given by the United Nations Refugee Agency, UNHCR, which was given permission to intervene in the High Court case and giving additional information concerning Rwanda's poor track record on protecting refugees. The British government insists that the plan to send asylum seekers to Rwanda is workable and an essential deterrent to prevent large numbers of people crossing the English Channel into Britain. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has made Stop the Boats one of his key undertakings before the next general election. Last year, a record 45,756 people crossed the English Channel in small boats. So far this year, more than 5,000 people have made the crossing, a similar figure to this time last year, before the Rwanda announcement was made. A decision known as an interim measure was issued by the European Court of Human Rights just hours before the first Rwanda flight was due to take off on 14th of June last year, which halted the flight. The European Court of Human Rights, ECHR, said it took particular account of evidence that asylum seekers transferred from the UK to Rwanda will not have access to fair and efficient procedures for the determination of their asylum claims.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kHz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to another edition of Spotlight. Foreign ministers of the Arab League member states have agreed to reinstate Syria's membership after its suspension more than 10 years ago. The turn of events comes amid a flurry of regional normalization of ties with Damascus in recent weeks. In this edition of Spotlight, we will discuss the significance of this development ahead of the Arab League summit, which is set to be held in Saudi Arabia on May 19th. What this means for the region and for the world. To do so, we're joined by Laith Maarouf, activist and political commentator, who is joining us live from Beirut. We also have with us Peter Ford, a former British ambassador to Syria, who is joining us from Manchester. Thank you very much to both of you, gentlemen. Let's begin with Mr. Maarouf from Beirut. Mr. Maarouf, Syria's Arab League membership was revoked in 2011. What was the reason behind this in the first place?
Clearly, the reason behind it was the pressure of the United States on its local vessels to push out Syria, who was defending itself against an invasion by Wahhabi death squads funded by the local vessels of the United States and backed by the CIA. Today, what we see is a return of the Arab League to Syria. It is not a return of Syria to the Arab League. It's a return of the Arab League to Syria and a return of all those countries that at one moment over those 11 years harmed Syria, coming back for ending those hostilities and almost begging for goodwill. And so now we see the importance of geography in the sense that Ibn Khaldun will tell us the fate that is written for Damascus because of its geographic location. The region cannot have a balance without Damascus being at the center of it. And of course, we see the Arab League coming back to Damascus. We see Turkey attempting to end its hostilities with Syria and a blossoming of the axis of resistance led with Iran, the president arriving in the last 2 days to Damascus also. So that's the importance of geography and the fate of the country of Syria.
Exactly. Those are very important issues you just mentioned. And 2023 seems to be a year of turning a new page, if you will, for regional developments as far as Syria is concerned. Let's bring in Mr. Ford. Mr. Ford, can you shed more light on the geostrategic location of Syria? And why didn't these countries consider this in the first place when they decided that Syria should not be part of the Arab League? Didn't they know how important Syria was? What did they have in mind back then?
Well, I think they had been deceived by the United States, which was telling them that, according to U.S. intelligence, the Assad government was bound to fall. It was just a matter of time. And the Arab states, or many of them, thought that they would join the U.S. push to overthrow the government of Syria. Some of them, let's not forget, also were supporting very actively some of the Gulf countries, particularly, were supporting the armed opposition groups. So they wanted to isolate Syria anyway. But a big factor was the U.S. pressure on Arab states.
So, Mr. Ford, do you believe that Bashar Assad's, let's say, the way he has solidified his position in Syria is the reason why these Arab countries are turning back towards Syria?
That's a big part of the reason, but there are other factors in play. It's very interesting now we're seeing the Arab world, led particularly by Saudi Arabia, in a new partnership with Cairo, more defiant towards America, no longer prepared to be dictated to by the United States. Believe me, this development is a bitter blow for the United States. They tried to pressure countries like Jordan, weaker countries, not to join in the consensus, but this failed. This year, partly as a result of the geopolitical situation with Ukraine, partly because of general U.S. Weakness and failure, from Afghanistan through Ukraine and their China policy, the Arab countries are more ready to be independent, and that means readmitting Syria to the Arab League and, for most of them, normalizing relations.
So, Mr. Maruf, in your opinion, well, Saudi Arabia, we do know that it had long resisted normalization of ties with Damascus. Why this change of heart at this point in time?
As our guest mentioned just a minute ago, the international scene changing, the end of American hegemony and the rise of multipolarity. And we have to actually credit Syria for this rise of the new world of multipolar reality. Without the wall of Damascus, without the government of Syria, the military of Syria, the structures of Syria withstanding this 11 years of war and this international coalition that the United States led invading the country, Russia wouldn't be in a position today to actually defend itself, for instance, in Ukraine. Imagine if those Wahhabi death squads that the United States on Syria, if they survived, where they would be today and how they would be moved, as we see the Nazi militias being moved to the Ukraine. So Syria was actually the beginning of this multipolar world. It's the time when Russia took a position to finally intervene militarily in a location where the United States was invading with its proxies. So this is where we're at, and the world is changing. The Arab countries that may have been vessels of the United States for a good of 80 somewhat years since the end of World War I, World War II, are now finding themselves in a position where the United States cannot protect them, and their economic future is tied to Asia and Africa, not to Europe and North America. And that's why we see the shift. And of course, that increases the possibility that these former vessel states like the Saudi Arabia or the United Arab Emirates or others that are normalizing with Syria right now will have a colored revolution plotted against it by the United States any minute now.
So, Mr. Ford, Mr. Maruf did point out that there is a new world order that is emerging. Do you believe that the United States is losing its grip on the Eastern Hemisphere with its plots have failed regarding Syria?
Absolutely. They're losing its grip, as the previous speaker just said. The United States' push for global power more or less came to an end in about 2014, by which time it was beginning to fail in Syria. Syria had withstood the incoming tide from the U.S.-supported Arab Spring, and the tide had come to its highest point. And the same could be said about Ukraine. 2014 was an important year there also. And so everything we've seen in the last 9 years has been a weakening of the U.S. Stranglehold over the Middle East. There have been other important milestones as well, like the tanker war in the Gulf in about 2018. Which saw, among other things, an attack on a Saudi refinery. This proved that America could not defend its allies, and those allies, like Saudi Arabia, have now become realistic, are making peace with their old enemies, like Iran, and have realized that the best way to have security is not to have enemies.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
So, Mr. Maruf, Saudi Arabian Foreign Minister Prince Faisal bin Farhan visited Damascus last month for the first time in more than a decade. The two countries have decided to reopen their embassies, restore flights between the two countries. What is the significance of this escalation in bilateral ties, this rapprochement, if you will?
Well, basically, Saudi Arabia currently is the biggest financier and of most of the Arab states, let's say. And that's why we see the Arab League right now jumping very fast into returning Syria into the organization because Saudi Arabia said so. And it means also the same thing for the Gulf states and the Gulf Cooperation Council. What Saudi Arabia says to these countries happens. So what does this mean? This means that right now we will see an acceleration of this normalization between all the Arab states and Syria, the former states that stayed out of Syria since 2011. And partially, we will see some of those states paying a price for it, as we see Egypt already paying a price for that reality with the war in Sudan being instigated by the United States and Israel to weaken it in this state. So we will see an increase of probable problems in those countries that are now normalizing with Syria by the United States pressure. And as you know, the reality is that Syria will be the winner of this no matter what. And it shows that resistance to American invasions is the right way to go. And it's worse to be a friend of the United States than to be an enemy.
Interesting. So Mr. Ford, Jordan, Kuwait and Qatar oppose Bashar al-Assad's presence in the Arab League. What are the reasons behind that, and how do you foresee the future for these three countries?
Well, each one of those is different. Jordan is weak, less able to withstand U.S. Pressure. Qatar has its particular problems with Saudi Arabia and never wants to follow a Saudi lead. That there is a struggle between the petrol superpower Saudi Arabia and the gas superpower Qatar, and at the moment the Saudis are winning. Kuwait has always been a maverick, but thankfully does not have huge significance today. What matters now is Saudi leadership. We will, in a matter of days, by May 19, the Arab summit, we will see Assad, no doubt, being welcomed at the Arab League summit in Riyadh. This will be a bitter blow for the United States. And it's also very important for what happens now inside Syria. The opposition, what's left of it, will be even more demoralized. The momentum now is all with the Syrian government. No doubt after the Turkish elections, the Turks will withdraw their troops from Syria. And all that remains then is for the armed opposition groups to negotiate terms of surrender. And this will leave the United States isolated as the remaining holdout.
So, Mr. Maruf, we discussed a new world order emerging, and of course, Mr. Ford also shed more light on the role that the United States used to play in the region and how that role has diminished. Now let's put Iran in the mix. Let's not forget that all of this is happening while Saudi Arabia and Iran have also reestablished their diplomatic ties and they're growing closer. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi visited Damascus just a few days ago, and that was, of course, a historic visit after nearly 12 years, a very important visit with lots of agreements being signed, bilateral relations expanding, particularly in trade and business. Tell us, what role does Iran play in this entire equation?
Well, of course, that visit was historic, and it solidified the alliance between Syria and Turkey that has been unshakable since the Islamic Revolution in 1979. And it was also a signal to the Arab countries like Saudi Arabia, who may think that opening up the Arab League and some rebuilding and connections with Syria may sway Syria away from its brotherly relationship with Iran, that this will never happen. Of course, we must remember that Syria, in multiple times over the last, 20-somewhat years since the invasion of Iraq, has been pressured and by the United States and offered much wealth and much trade if it gives up both the resistance in Lebanon and its relationship with Iran, and that never happened even under the pressures of the war that lasted 10 years on Syria. So this is a very important also significance for Iran to show, this relationship, how for anybody else around the region, to show how this brotherly relationship is extendable to anybody, that we don't need foreign imperial forces in the region to safeguard everybody's security, and that only relationships that are brotherly between the nations of the region will guarantee that security. This is the significance of that visit.
That's an interesting point you raise there. So, Mr. Ford, it seems that the divide and rule policy that the West particularly has been trying to implement in the Eastern Hemisphere is now failing. Can you shed more light on that and, of course, Iran's role in this entire normalization of ties that we see?
Well, what's happened has been a victory for steadfastness. The Arabs call it sumud, steadfastness. And there's a steadfastness front, which includes Syria and Iran and Hezbollah and some of the Palestinian groups, and they have shown patience over the last 12 years, patience which is now being rewarded at great speed. The momentum now is all with the resistance front, the steadfastness front, and the absolute pivot for this has been Iran. Without Iran, Syria would have fallen by 2014 or earlier. This is, on the part of the United States, Syria was always, the war against Syria by America was always just a prelude to and part of the war against Iran. It was a way primarily to weaken Iran